the Great Seal of the United States. I understand that some people might consider this entire interpretation of Great Pyramid prophecy to be numerology, and therefore lacking in any scientific credibility. However, no one can deny that this same symbolic message of a returning capstone was forever enshrined on the reverse side of the Great Seal of the United States. The strange symbol of a single eye inside a gleaming white triangle descending onto a 13-course pyramid has appeared on every U.S. dollar bill in circulation since the 1930s. The Great Seal was first proposed on the very day the Declaration of Independence was signed, July 4, 1776. Thomas Jefferson commissioned a French West Indian portrait painter named Eugene Pierre du Simetier to create the original design, which was then approved by Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams. Even in these earliest versions, the Eye of Providence, a single eye gleaming with light, appears over the pyramid. The original phrase that was written around the pyramid was Deo favente perennis. Deo means God, as well as the open sky, and something that is charged with the brightness of day. The word favente means favor, befriend, support, and back up, and perennis means continual, everlasting, perpetual, perennial, and eternal. So a loose translation would be, God supports us eternally. In Latin, the word perennial means yearly, something that repeats every year. So this could be another reference to the great year of precession. God supports the great year. Some of the earliest American currency featured the unfinished pyramid as the main symbol on the front, although in this case, the Eye of Providence did not appear at the top. As we now know, the pyramid is also a betel, the symbol of the pineal gland in many ancient cultures. Perhaps the Founding Fathers felt the inclusion of this obviously Masonic symbol, the awakened pineal gland, or third eye inside a triangle, would be too controversial for the early American colonists. In this case, the word perennis was written overhead by itself. By 1782, later revisions of the Great Seal changed the wording to what we now see, with Anuit Septus on the top and Novus Ordo Seclorum on the bottom. These phrases make the message even clearer. The word Anuit means to favor or smile on, often by nodding approval. And the word Septus means undertaking, as well as beginning, starting, and commencing. When we include the Eye of Providence as a symbol of God, the phrase thus translates as, God has favored our beginnings. However, there's deeper symbolism in this phrase as well. The word Anuit is related to other Latin words that mean yearly, and this is where we get the word annual from. One translation of the Latin word annui is a yearly payment. So Anuit Septus can also mean the great year begins. The payment we are expected to get from the great year appears to be written into the symbol itself, namely the transformation of the earth, where the precessional cycle begins again. This message is made much clearer when we delve into the mysterious roots of the phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum, which was incorporated into the Great Seal of the United States in 1782 by Charles Thompson. The official record openly states that Thompson was inspired by line 5 of Virgil's fourth eclogue, which we will discuss shortly. The original Latin reads Magnus ab integro seclorum nascitur ordo, and it is interpreted to mean, end the majestic roll of circling centuries, begins anew. This sounds very much like a description of the great cycle of precession, describing the majestic roll of circling centuries that now begins anew, creating a golden age in the process. The Great Roman Oracle. In my early years of intensive research, circa 1994, I found a direct quote from C.A.L. Totten, a first lieutenant in the 4th Artillery of the U.S. Army, who explained the deeper meaning of the Great Seal. This was published as a letter he wrote to Charles J. Folger, the Secretary of the Treasury, on February 10, 1882. The all-seeing eye is one of the oldest hieroglyphics of the deity. The triangle also is a Kabbalistic symbol of the most remote antiquity. The descent of the mystic eye and triangle in the form of a capstone to this mysterious monument, the Great Pyramid, of all times and nations, is to us as a people most pregnant with significance. The motto, Novus Ordo Seclorum, is a quotation from the 4th Eclogue and was borrowed in turn by Virgil from the mystic Sibylline records. Totten goes on to give the exact quote, which is stunning. But first, let's explore the mystic Sibylline records in greater detail so we understand the context. In the early days of the formation of Rome, the name Sibyl was derived from the Greek word Sibylla, which meant a woman who gives prophecies, also known as an oracle. The oracle at Delphi hosted the mysterious Omphalos stone, a symbol of the pineal gland that was also believed to be a direct telepathic conduit to the god Apollo. There were 10 famous Sibyls throughout the ancient world, including Persia, Libya, Delphi, Samos, Samaria, Erythrea, Tiber, Marpessus, and Phrygia. But the most highly revered was the Sibyl of Cumae, who lived in a cave near Naples. Cumae was the first Greek colony founded in Italy in a volcanic region near Mount Vesuvius. In 1932, the Sibyl of Cumae's cave was discovered, dispelling rumors that she was only a myth, and it had a 60-foot-high ceiling and a 375-foot-long passage leading into it. The Sibyl wrote her prophecies on oak leaves, which she then left outside the cave at any one of 100 different entrances. If no one came to pick them up when they arrived, they simply blew away in the wind. A 2001 National Geographic article suggested that the oracle's mystical abilities may have been the result of hallucinogenic gases such as ethylene that naturally appear in the caves. Spring water near the site of the temple at Delphi tested positive for ethylene, which has a sweet smell and creates a narcotic effect. Apparently, the Cumaean Sibyl would sit on top of a tripod that was built directly over a grotto within the cave that volcanic gases would rise through. She also swallowed a few drops of bay laurel juice before entering into the trance state where she received the prophecies. Virgil gave an intense description of the Sibyl of Cumae at work in the Aeneid. Her behavior definitely suggests a powerful hypnotic influence had taken hold of her. She changes her features and the color of her countenance. Her hair springs up erect. Her bosom heaves and pants. Her wild heart beats violently. The foam gathers on her lips and her voice is terrible. She paces to and fro in her cave and gesticulates as if she would expel the gods from her breast. During the time of the 50th annual Olympic Games and the founding of the city of Rome, the Sibyl of Cumae approached King Tarquin with 9 books of her prophecies, claiming they contained the entire future history of Rome. Tarquin ruled from 534 to 510 BC. This wizened old woman asked the king for 9 bags of gold as payment, and he refused her exorbitant price. Right in front of King Tarquin, she burned the first 3 of the 9 books, which at the time he didn't think was a big deal. However, her fame and reputation as a prophetess quickly grew, and when she later returned, she offered Tarquin the remaining 6 books for the same price. Again, he refused. And again, she burned the next 3 books right in front of him, making her seem all the more crazy. Nonetheless, by the time she returned with the final 3 books, she had become truly legendary for her accuracy. The king's advisors urged him to accept her offer, even though she still asked him for 9 bags of gold, and he finally accepted. Regardless of what any skeptics may think in modern times about the art of prophecy, the Sibylline leaves were soon considered to be the greatest treasure in all of Rome, precious beyond any and all other government assets. They were renowned for their stunning accuracy, which apparently included a prediction of the invasion of Hannibal and his eventual defeat 700 years before it happened, as well as a prediction of Constantine by name 800 years before he was born. They were consulted in times of great national emergency, such as earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, diseases, and hardship. Michelangelo even included a depiction of the Sibyl of Cumae in his famous painting of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. As the Sibyl of Cumae originally described to Tarquin, these books apparently did contain the future history of Rome. But the problem was that the prophecies were worded in cryptic language that was not always clear. In many cases, when Roman emperors attempted to use the mystery text to avoid a major catastrophe, they ended up actually fulfilling the prophecy they had hoped to prevent. For this reason, the books were considered to be potentially dangerous. By trying to use them to stop a disaster from happening, you might actually create the disaster. They were thus kept under high security in vaults within subterranean chambers in the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill in Rome, accessible only to the high priests. The chambers in the temple were completed as of 500 BC, specifically to store this treasure, which was only to be consulted in the most severe emergencies. The Roman Senate considered the texts so valuable that ultimately an entire college of priests was tasked to either track down or re-envision the first 6 lost volumes. They never succeeded in recovering the original words of the Sibyl. When Marcus Atilius authorized someone to copy the original 3 books, going against the official secrecy, he was punished by death, sewn into a sack, and thrown into the Tiber River. Virgil was finally allowed to copy some of the texts into his eclogues as of AD 82, and the Temple of Jupiter then burned in AD 83, destroying most, if not all, of the originals. General Flavius Stilicho burned the remaining copies in AD 405, believing them to be pagan and evil. 5 years later, when Rome was invaded by the Visigoths, some felt this was Rome's punishment for having destroyed the prophetic texts. Virgil's 4th eclogue is thus believed to be one of the last remaining transcripts of the original Sibylline texts. The fact that Novus Ordo Seclorum was directly adopted from these mystery texts and was combined with the Great Pyramid in the design of the Great Seal of the United States as of 1782 makes the story of the Founding Fathers much more interesting. Peter Tompkins wrote about this in Secrets of the Great Pyramid. According to Manly P. Hall, an expert on Masonic lore, not only were many of the founders of the U.S. government Masons, but they received aid from a secret and august body existing in Europe, which helped them to establish the United States for a peculiar and particular purpose known only to the initiated few. The Great Seal, says Hall, was the signature of this exalted body, and the unfinished pyramid on its reverse side is a trestle board, setting forth symbolically the task to the accomplishment of which the U.S. government was dedicated from the day of its inception. The eagle was apparently intended to represent a phoenix, or symbol of the immortality of the human soul. Great currency has been given to the pyramid and phoenix symbols by placing them upon a $1 bill.